Welcome aboard on a Friday and a special treat to get the program going today and head us into the weekend on a good note. Mike Emmerich joins us. Doc, thanks for doing this. It was kind of I asked last night, so it was kind of a late offer to come on the show this week, but I appreciate you saying yes and joining us.
Not at all, Dennis. It's good to talk to you. You know, I was thinking about driving home just a few moments ago. When was your first year at the station?
1996.
Do you realize that I think I'm pretty safe on this, going back to the early years of WHLS and including WPHM, you have been the longest-serving sports guy in the history of the stations in Port Huron?
Wow, I wouldn't,
no,
I wouldn't have realized
that. I don't think there's
anybody
close, as a matter of fact. And I think that would include, you know, in terms of regular sports coverage. Now, there were staff announcers in the 30s and 40s. Now, that doesn't include, of course, you know, the likes of John Hill and people that did morning shows and things that weren't related to sports. But that was the thing I was trying to compute, because I knew it was in the 90s. And then, now that did not include the time in with other teams. But I didn't know what the total number of years might be. But that has to be the record for broadcasting in Port Huron in terms of being the sports guy.
Yeah,
it has to be.
There was there were two hockey seasons that I was away.
Right.
I left
one in Louisville.
I left the end of the summer '99, but I was back by 2001 in the spring.
Right. Okay. Well, I thought so. So the total would be, and my math is terrible. So the raw total of the number of years you've been covering sports in Port Huron would be what?
I just guesstimate I'm somewhere between 25 and 30.
Yeah, so that's got to be, because in the early years of broadcasting in Port Huron, they didn't have people exclusively assigned to it. Occasionally there were guys that were freelancers that would just come in and do the sports, and then they had other jobs, but in terms of that being the main thing, you're by far the guy. So anyway, congratulations for that. And I know you have a hockey game to do tomorrow and lots of other things that you're doing, including Silver Stick coming up. So my hat is off to you.
Well, I don't think I'm going to catch you in games, but I wanted to throw a name at you, Doc.
Yeah.
Because he's working this year in the Federal Hockey League, doing the games in Battle Creek. I feel bad for him because Battle Creek is so bad.
Yeah, I know. Have they won a game yet?
No, not yet. Oh, it's
okay.
Like 0-25 now going into
he
the weekend.
He was going to get in touch with you. Did he do that?
I haven't talked to him, but Brady talked to him.
Oh, okay.
But at any rate, Terry Ficcarelli is getting close to, I think it's 4,000 broadcasts.
That would not surprise me, because he started, actually before I did in Port Huron, he was working games with Carl Robertson in Flint in the early 1970s, so he would have predated my arrival into pro hockey. I think I was still at Bowling Green when he began doing professional games, working with Carl Robertson and Flint. So that would not surprise me that he would be near 4,000. I don't know what my number is; it's in the high threes. But he loves the sport. He loves broadcasting the sport, and he has been in several cities doing it. And I only wish, like you do, that he was with a better team. But it seems as though, doesn't it, Dennis, that the Federal League winds up with one of these teams every year. Remember the one in Southern Ontario, and then there was one in Dayton that just couldn't win a hockey game and eventually wound up with a shortage of players, and they had only a few that would show up on the roster certain nights. It's sad.
Yeah, well, I mean, everything that I'm hearing is that what they're doing off ice is very professional.
In Battle Creek?
And they're doing the right things. I just feel like the market is really too small to generate enough interest in it. But the on-ice product, I mean, it was slapped together so quickly. And you know, that you only get the guys that weren't dressing for games or were the extra forward or extra D guy for games. It's kind of hard to put together a competitive team, and it's really been a struggle for them. They've already had a coaching change, which I kind of feel like, how unfair to the first guy. How did they expect him to win?
Yeah, and not much of a chance, but that also happens when you are so anxious to show a team to fans in a new city that you throw it together too fast. And yeah, that it's regrettable. I'm happy for Terry that he's with the team, but I'm also disappointed that he has to broadcast so many losses, and probably some of them are not close.
Yeah, so some of them are actually pretty bad on average. I think an average score, if I'm just doing some quick math here, the average score of one of their games is like 7-2.
Yeah. He was with some longtime fans. We don't want to leave the majority of your listeners who are younger than 60 behind. But when the Port Huron team lost its affiliation with Detroit in 1974, it was because Kalamazoo came into the league and became the Kalamazoo K-Wings. And it was at that point that Terry wound up as the announcer in Kalamazoo. And they had incredible rivalries with Port Huron that, because it was the mid-70s, wound up with lots of fisticuffs and occasional visits by their coach, who was a colorful character named Bob Lemieux, paying visits to the fans in the individual metal chairs in the lower parts of McMorran. And I believe there was an incident where a couple of the Kalamazoo players fired pucks into the Zamboni as it was going around the ice, and then there was a public apology made by those two players who shall remain nameless. Oh, heck, they were Alvin White and Leonard Candia. So there was a lot of that going on, and Terry was the announcer there. And I remember one night in the middle of one of those melees, because at that time, and maybe it's still that way whenever you have broadcasters from both teams, one was at one end, and it's the end that I recall you working several times, Dennis, at the east end of the broadcasting area in the press box. And then the other announcer would work at the west end, and I remember overhearing him in my headset saying, "Circle such and such a date on your calendar. That's when Port Huron comes to Kalamazoo, and we'll see how tough they are that night." But those were the days, weren't they, in the 1970s when Boston and Philadelphia were winning Stanley Cups with roughhouse teams, and so it was a different sport at that time than in a lot of places it is now. But so he goes back a long way, that's for sure.
Good stuff. He was always good to me. When I broke in it was the Colonial League, I guess, my first season. But he was in Muskegon, and he was one of the guys that right off the hop was really friendly and kind of, you know, took me under his wing. And these are the people in the league that, you know, you need to get to know. These are the people in the league you need to avoid, you know, and this is what
he
you...
He would be that way. He was always very friendly. Yeah. That's there are ambassadors that the sport has had for a number of years, and he has always been one. So I'm happy that he has a team, and as I said, I wish they were a little better, but if they hang in there, Kalamazoo was terrible the first year. They were colorful but terrible, and then they got a lot better as the years went on, and I think they were a finalist in the IHL about 3 years after they were founded. So,
well, I know the Prowlers are going good right now, Doc. They've won eight in a row. They've got Delaware in town this weekend for a couple of games. Another one of the expansion teams that have struggled so far, but they at least have won five or six games. So
yeah,
they're not quite as bad as
Battle
Creek.
And the turnouts on some of these games will start to, I'm sure, get better once. Well, I'm not sure how many potential customers have been lost to those wanting to watch the Lions on television or wanting to watch the Wolverines in some of their key games. That was always a factor that at one time when I was involved in the marketing of the team in Port Huron, we were always concerned about what we were up against. And I'm not certain how much that enters into it, but we sure hope people turn out to see the guys play because they do indeed try hard. And Joe Pace Jr. is not dull.
No, he's very entertaining. both on and off the ice.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, it's fun to have a team in town, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Got to ask you, Doc, and I know it's been played in warmer climates, because I believe they did one in California a few years back.
Yeah, Dodger Stadium, it was 63 degrees there, and the ice was among the best that we've ever had.
Wow. So Texas was not an issue?
No. In essence, it was very lucky that they had the game at all, but had that rainstorm that we documented come later in the weekend, we might have had to postpone the game for a day or two. Here's what happened. I'll try to do it in a nutshell. How much time do we have?
You got about 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, late Friday night into Saturday, the humidity rose, the temperature rose into the 60s, and down came 2 inches of nonstop rain all the way through Friday night into Saturday afternoon, and it didn't stop until 5 o'clock. They had been there since the 17th of December, and so now we're looking at the 27th. They had built the ice beginning on the 17th. It had been fine. They had the white paint down. They had the lines painted. The logos were there, and the logos are actually made of fabric, so they don't have to be hand-painted or anything. They lost everything. They had to take the end boards down because there was 2 inches of standing water by the time the rain stopped at 5 o'clock Central Time on Saturday. They attached a 12-foot squeegee, which they have, to the ice resurfacing machine, pushed it around to get the excess water that was standing there. It's like your bathtub. There's no place for it to go. There's no plug to pull, so you have to get it out the end. They pushed all of that off, but they lost all the ice. They had to start over again. And so Derek King, who was in charge of the ice there, had 2 8-man crews. They worked 36 straight hours. They started building the ice back up at 5:30 Saturday afternoon after the rain stopped. 36 straight hours, 4,500 gallons of water. By Sunday evening, they had an ice surface back, not one you could skate on. But they were able to put the white paint back in, put the logos back in, paint the lines on. By Monday, it was skateable. And Rick Bowness, the Dallas coach, said he was certain, because of what happened Saturday, that they would not even be allowed to practice on Tuesday. They had practices on Tuesday, and they had a game on Wednesday. But it was miraculous, because had that occurred a day or so later, the game couldn't have been played on New Year's Day. It would have had to have been later. It was that bizarre. But in answer to your question, yes, it is. It was a southern climate, and had it not been for the rain, there's no issue. There may be if we tried South Florida or if we tried Arizona or if we tried Vegas, but there's no issue with almost any temperature now in terms of making ice.
It's unbelievable, and it's amazing the job the people who do this stuff, what they're able to do.
Yeah, and you consider the one at Ralph Wilson Stadium where we had several stoppages, and that was cold weather. That was Pittsburgh and Buffalo in 2009. That was cold weather, and we still had lots of issue. We were building on plywood then, and, you know, it was just an awful lot different. But we learned so much from these outdoor games, and this was the 29th one. The one at Ralph Wilson was only the second one that the NHL had ever done. So a lot has been learned from all of these games, and so it was borne out by the fact that they could pull off a miracle and actually hold the game on schedule on January 1st like they had wanted to.
Still think that 2009 game is probably the best one, probably because it was still new and unique.
Yeah,
and just the snow
and
the drama.
I think it was one of the most exciting because of all of that. And there was a question about selling all the tickets for the game even into the week before the game. But then because of all of the things that happened and the storybook finish and your favorite player scoring in the shootout, I'm being sarcastic, all of a sudden this took on a new life, and then teams wanted these games in the worst way. So now 25 of the 31 teams have had an outdoor game so far. So there are others that want them and they want to host them, but that was the one. In my mind, I've done 19 of the 29, and my favorite still, not because I'm a Michigan guy, but my favorite still is the one in Ann Arbor because It was 13 degrees. It snowed all day. The outcome was in doubt to the very end. It went into a shootout. And the house was divided, the big house was. It was the largest crowd ever, and it's going to be that way for a long time. And there was a real celebration of the sport even after. Because of the snow, they couldn't park on the golf course. It was chaotic trying to get your car out of there. But there were Toronto fans pushing the cars of Detroit fans out of snowdrifts. And it was just basically a joyous atmosphere. So that's why I have such a great memory of that one.
Wow, good stuff. Doc, I wish I had more time.
Yeah, I do too. But anyway, we'll do this again. We have a game coming up that I'm supposed to do at Little Caesars Arena with Boston on a Sunday afternoon in early February. So I'll invite myself on if I can be so brazen. Maybe before that, you and I can hook up and talk a little more about the Red Wings, who right now are 13 points in the lead for 31st to 30th. And so they'll have more balls in the lottery when that.
Oop, I think we might have lost Doc there.
Sorry. Take care.
Yep. See you, Doc.
All right.
There's Mike Emmerich joining us on the program. Always a lot of fun. We'll be back.